Appreciate very much the opportunity of being with you. I've been looking forward to it ever since the invitation came. And I'd like to say just a word or two. It won't take too much time, but good to see Robert and Linda again. We first met them in 1983 when we moved to Elizabethtown, Kentucky. And I was thinking on driving over this morning that he was among the group of men that came from Elizabethtown to Murray, where we lived at the time, to help pack our stuff up and move it to Elizabethtown when we moved there. And after a year or so, they moved to Hopkinsville. And so we stopped by a few times passing through, but it's good to see them again after a number of years. And it's good to be with you, and I hope that the things we do throughout this meeting will be beneficial to all of you. I don't claim to be an expert on the subject of Revelation, but I want to give you a definition of an expert that I heard many years ago. An expert, I was told, is an ordinary fellow a long way from home. That's all it is. Jesus talked about a person not receiving honor among his own people, and that kind of fits into that kind of situation. Let's get right into our study, because we have a lot of material we're going to try to cover. But I want also to make a little statement about the handout. I brought two things, which some of you already have. One is a brief synopsis of the book of Revelation. It has a very summary. It really summarizes about what I did when I was teaching classes. We took at least 13 weeks or 13 lessons going through this series. And every time beginning at the new class, I'd go back and recap what we did before. And maybe about the last time I went through it in Foley, Alabama, where we lived for about 11 years, one of the brethren says, "Why don't you put that on paper so we'll have it down and we'll have it to keep?" And so what you have is essentially the written version of what I was doing, and it will help you, I think, just to get an overall view of what the book of Revelation is about. The second thing is that we have the handouts of all the charts that I will use, so you won't have to try to take notes. And so this may help you to free your mind just to think about what we're doing. We'll begin with our study. And I want to suggest, first of all, that the book of Revelation is, I think, a neglected and a misunderstood and grossly perverted book. And sometimes people despair because they have problems understanding. We should not despair in our efforts to understand it. One of the reasons why we have a problem understanding the book of Revelation is that many people have not studied the Old Testament. And because they do not understand the symbolism that is used in the Old Testament, they cannot imagine what the book of Revelation is all about. That's one of the problems that we have. A second problem is that we don't use the symbolism in numbers, as we find various numbers being used in the book of Revelation. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit as we go along. First thing I want to discuss is just think about the symbolism and bring just a suggestion about the significance of the various numbers that you'll find. The number one is emphasis of unity. We learned that when we talked about being one Lord, one faith, one baptism, and we see the implication of it there. Two would be a symbol of strength. The Old Testament teaches that you could not convict a person except you had at least two witnesses to testify against him. One witness was not suffice. Three would be a suggestion that of completeness, or ordered whole. And so sometimes we find the number three, sometimes the number two. Four would be a comprehensive completeness. And on the back page of the little folded section that you have the discussion of these. The International Bible Encyclopedia said three is a complete and ordered whole. Three persons in the Godhead, Christ raised on the third day. So it would be considered a sacred number. Number four was a symbol for comprehensive extent or completeness. The four winds blow from the four corners of the earth. We find this in the book of Revelation. And there are four living creatures around the throne when we describe the vision of God upon his throne. The number seven is likewise a number, has quite a great deal of emphasis in the book of Revelation, and it is a sacred number associated with completeness, fulfillment, and perfection. The New Bible Dictionary has this definition. There were seven churches, seven golden candlesticks, seven stars, seven angels, seven lamps of fire, seven spirits of God, seven seals, seven horns, seven eyes on the Lamb, seven angels with seven trumpets, seven heads on the dragon and the beast, and seven last plagues. So over and over and over again, the number seven comes up in the book of Revelation, the complete number, sacred in way, either pretended or real. Number 10 is a human completeness. It means there's a completeness of a human. We've got 10 fingers and 10 toes, most of us. Some people have had 6 fingers on a hand and 6 fingers on their feet. But most of us have 10. So, and then we have 10 days of tribulation, 10 horns, 10 royal diadems, 10 kings mentioned. The number 12 would be a religious number. Let me get down one more on this. The number 12 is a religious number, and I didn't get that. I skipped that on the chart. But anyway, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles of Christ. When you get to the figuring the numbers, they take the multiple of 3 times 4. 3 times 4 is equal 12. And Plato, in his writings, according to International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, says that this is a perfect number in the numerology of that particular period of time. And then we come to the 1,000. This is the result of multiplying 10 times 10 times 10. So it's 10 to the third power. It represents perfection, the ultimate. And so we have the 1,000 years mentioned in Revelation chapter 20. The 144,000 also is a multiple resulting of 10 times or 12 times 12 times 1,000. So you put the significance of 12, the significance of 1,000 together, and you have that. We'll look at that as we go through. 3.5 is a half of 7. Represents trials and hardships. Also in contrast with the perfect 7, represents a broken, incomplete period when we think about time. And other different ways of expressing that would be the 42 months, the 1,260 days, or time times and a half of time. All that refers to this same idea involved. The number 6 is said in the book of Revelation chapter 13, verse 18, and it is said to be the number of man. Not a man, but man. Man always falls short of perfection. And so the number 666 became a bad omen in that particular period of time. And so 6 is the bad omen. 666 is worse. You multiply the 6s, and so it's a symbol that's used for the beast. So this I think might help us. If we just kind of keep this in mind, you have the notes as we go through, and so we try to keep that in mind in thinking about some of the numbers as we talk about it. And we study in the class this morning, we're going to talk about an introductory material. We're not going to get into the text of the book until the next hour. But we want to think about these points. The title of the book, the nature of apocalyptic literature, what that means, the author, the writer, the time it was written, and the methods of interpretation. I want to be sure I get to that in the class in this particular hour. And then we'll finally end up with the themes and the purpose of the book. So first of all, think about the title. As you begin to read in Revelation chapter 1, you might notice in your Bible that it says in some that it's the revelation of John. And my New King James Version says it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And that is a proper rendition of the title, because the very first verse says, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place, he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ and to all things that he saw. Blessed is he who reads, those who hear the words of this prophecy, and keep the things which are written in it, for the time is near." So this is the section that we want to focus upon in our study. We look at the idea, the revelation of John. That word revelation is a key to something that we need to desperately understand. Somebody says the book of Revelation is so mysterious, it's impossible to understand. Look at all the different things that people say about it. And because of the confusion among various commentators and writers, it oftentimes causes people to just pass by and say, nobody can understand it, so why should I try? Martin Luther applied his subjective criticism to the book, as he did to the book of Ephesians, says his spirit couldn't adjust itself to this book. He thought that the apostle should write in plain language without any symbolism, without all these symbolic terms or visions. And so he just discounted the book of Revelation because it just didn't fit his idea. A lot of Christians today, they accept the fact that it is Scripture, but a lot of times they quit reading when they get to the end of the book of Jude. And a lot of Bible classes don't skip that last book in the Bible. I know that you've been working on that and have gone and worked at it more and more, so you're commendable for even trying to work your way through it. But a lot of folks, they reread the first chapter, first three chapters. We can not too bad off there, so we'll go that far. But when we get to chapter 4 and on through the book, then we're so totally confused. And perhaps one of the reasons is that we don't know how to start, and that how to approach the book makes it more the thing. So the word translated revelation is a word that means an uncovering. Thayer says it means an uncovering, properly a laying bare, making naked. And it comes from the word apocalypto, which means to uncover or reveal or unveil. So the purpose of the writer and the purpose of the book is not to cover up the message, but to make the message increasingly vivid by unveiling through these signs and symbols the present glory of Christ and His power to give victory to the saints of God. This is the fundamental theme of the entire book. Christ has power. One of the first visions is His glory, and He encourages Christians to think about, ultimately, we'll find at the end of the book, that He is victorious over every enemy that Christians have. And we can take consolation in that message fundamentally. Now, the second thing is we think about the nature of apocalyptic literature. This term apocalypse is adopted to describe the kind of a literature that is in this book. In other books, prior to John, no book was ever described as apocalypse. But this word comes from the Greek title of the book, and is used to describe the various literature that is rather common in Old Testament times prior to the New Testament period. Several factors about it. The style of apocalyptic literature is generally figurative. So we have to look at the figures, the symbols, and that was common in some of those writings. And many of the characters and much of the phraseology in the book of Revelation and in other apocalyptic literature were drawn from biblical writings. Information is conveyed by the announcement of angels and visions by other supernatural means. And there is an attempt to portray vividly the unseen world. You can't see the world that lies behind the action going on in the present world. And so this is a part of that type of literature, not only in the book of Revelation, but in other. And then the writer's name was usually pseudonymous. He used somebody else's name, maybe some famous character, and tried to use that name to promote the reading of his material. Now, apocalyptic literature is found other than in the book of Revelation. Milton's Paradise Lost, for instance, if you remember that when you went to high school. It's used a lot of biblical imagery in that book. It's apocalyptic in style and scope. And also the writers that in the pre-time of the Gospels also use that type of literature. Some of the apocalyptic books of the Bible, which the Catholics have in their Bible, has some of that in it. But generally, apocalyptic literature came about in hard times. And God unveiled to His people His own mighty power and disposition toward them through the language of this type of literature. Ezekiel, for instance, read Ezekiel, you have this kind of visions. In Ezekiel, you have this kind of visions in the book of Daniel, in the Babylonian exile period. And Daniel talked about the time, even until the time of the Greek, well, after Alexander the Great died, his territory was divided among his generals, and talks about the time, even down to the time of Antiochus of Syria, and to the Roman Empire, the Fourth World Empire. So the book of Revelation is written to encourage Christians during the time, and we're going to suggest why that it, we think it is during the time of the Roman persecution. So the basic premise of it and the basic thrust of it is to encourage Christians to endure the sufferings and the trials and tribulations that they are experiencing and will experience in the immediate future. And so this is some of the things involved. The writer is John, the son of Zebedee, apostle of Jesus Christ. And as we read in the first paragraph, he was told by an angel to write this book. But also, as you see in the first paragraph, the actual author of the book is God himself. God gave the revelation to Jesus Christ, who gave it to the angel, who gave it to John. And so this tells us how this came about. The revelation is not the apocalypse of John, it's the apocalypse of God. And we need to think about it. Now, the next point, we think about the time of writing. Now, there are two basic concepts among those who believe and accept the Bible as the inspired Word of God. And one is that some argue that it was written prior to AD 70. And there are a number of writers who take the position that it was written before the destruction of Jerusalem, probably about 68 or 69. Tradition says that John left Jerusalem about 67 and he moved to Ephesus. And so he was not in Jerusalem during the time of the Roman invasion. And so they're thinking that it was during that particular period of time. Lightfoot, MacDonald, Neander, Plummer, Schaff, Weiss, and others defend this early date. And among the brethren would be Foy Wallace and Brother Arthur Ogden. Both, I knew Brother Wallace, heard him speak a few times, but Arthur and I lived close together for many years, had a lot of respect for him. And I told Art several times that he just hadn't convinced me that the early date was the real date. And he was speaking one time and trying to show that he thought it was, why he thought it was the early date. But I told him that he still hadn't convinced me. The arguments that they usually use is evidence from particular idiom, Greek, Hebrew. And MacDonald says that it was as if one was unfamiliar with the Greek language, more familiar with Hebrew. And the argument is also that the Jewish state was still extant because it mentions the 12 tribes in chapter 7. Jerusalem was still standing because it measured the temple in chapter 11. And Nero, the sixth emperor on the throne, just died because you have one who was and he's not. And so he's the one that received that deadly wound mentioned in chapter 13. And MacDonald says that during the time of the latter part of the first century, there were only seven churches, indicating that only seven at the time. Probably says Colossae had already been destroyed by an earthquake or something by this time in the history. And then he talked about the activity of Judaizing teachers, which we all know from the readings of Paul's writings, especially the Galatians and the Romans and other parts of the New Testament, was a continuing problem. And they said there's no internal evidence for a later date and the weakness of the external evidence. Now, the second argument is concerning that it is during the latter part, the last decade of the first century. And I believe this is a better interpretation. This date is defended by most recent writers on the date. Alford, Hendrickson, Linsky, Moffat, Orr, Peters, Robertson, Summers, Sweat. And it's also among our brethren, a position taken by Brother Homer Haley, who taught the Old Testament and the book of Revelation extensively for a number of years, and by Brother Robert Harkrider. If you do not have Harkrider's book, it's an easy book to understand, and it'd be worth your money to buy it for the help that he can give you on the book of Revelation. He doesn't go into all the great details, but he does give you a good discussion of it. Now, the internal evidence the conditions of the churches, and he says that the early date does not suit the conditions as the latter date does. The general severity of the persecution is better presented as during the time of Domitian. And the external evidence also favors the latter date, one of which was the reference made in the Eusebius' church history. Persecution of Nero seems to have been confined primarily to the Rome. There was some persecution in Asia during that time. And even though it is now argued and understood that the persecution by Domitian was not as widespread as previously thought, but I ran across an article in the Biblical Archaeology Review magazine in 1993. It was written. And this article was written by Stephen Friesen, calling Ephesus Key of the Vision of Revelation. In this article, it showed that there were temples built. About 13 different temples were built in the province of Asia. And in Ephesus itself, a temple was built and a bath gymnasium was associated in that same area. And he also, if I remember correctly, after Domitian was killed, they chiseled his name off those monuments and temples and put the name of Vespasian and Titus, who was his father and brother. And so they dedicated the temples to the Flavian dynasty rather than to Domitian himself. And I wrote an article about this many years ago, and Arthur Ogden says, well, that doesn't prove that it was written in the last part of the first century. I said, no, it doesn't prove it. But what it does prove is that the situation was there where emperor worship was going on. It gives you a sense of the background, the kind of background culture from which this situation arose. So it seems to me that you have more weight to the latter date, which being in the last decade of the first century, probably AD 95 or 96. And I have some references that you might check. Brother Jenkins, Emperor Worship in the Book of Revelation, that's still available, I think, from the Florida College bookstore. Brother Harkwriter's book on Revelation has a good discussion of that. And then there was an exchange several years ago, discussion between Brother Ogden and Brother Jenkins on that issue. Now, we'll look about various interpretations. And maybe, when are we supposed to quit, by the way? About 15 minutes? Okay, I got a little time then. I want to talk about the various interpretations. And as I suggested briefly before, the sound interpretation has to begin with the people who lived in the day of John. What does the book of Revelation have to offer the book of John, to the people in John's own lifetime? John lived until about the end of the first century. And if we're correct in assigning this date, about 95, there were people in his contemporary people that he's trying to encourage. And we need to understand what he was trying to say to them, and then see if what he said to them might apply to us today. If we forget about the implication and applications that were to be made by the people who first read this book or heard it read, he talked about blessed are those who read and those who hear. It was intended to be read publicly in the assemblies of the church. And so the blessing was upon those who read to the congregations, and blessing upon those who heard the congregation, heard the material here, and blessing upon those who put into practice what they learned from the book. It was for their benefit at that time. And many of the predictions include principles, although, that are broadly represented, and the principles may not be confined to that one particular decade or to the next 50 years, but there are principles that you and I can gain and lessons that we can learn from the principles that are laid down in this book. But we need to understand the church is the suffering of the church is typical of the persecution that we might face in any period of time. So that encouragement that comes because of their persecutions and what Jesus had to say about their situation also can encourage us to know the same principles about Him. There are about five different approaches that people take. Many years ago, I was quite confused, as many people are, about Revelation. I bought a little book called Worthy is the Lamb by Ray Summers, who's a professor and a Baptist professor. And it happened to open, he helped open my eyes because he focused upon the fact that you're, what you come out with through the book of Revelation, your understanding of its application is going to depend a whole lot on what you have, what idea you have going into it. What is this book all about? And there are about five different approaches that people take. Number one is the futurist. This is represented by the millennials, premillennial, dispensational groups. They consider it to be proof, unfulfilled prophecy even until now. Much of the book of Revelation is not fulfilled. You might have heard some dispensationalists discussing the seven churches. They represent seven different ages of the church. We're today living in the Laodicean age, in different period of time that people have. So they place chapters 4 through 19 just before the second coming of Christ. And then they have the millennial reign, the 1,000 years of reign on earth is their interpretation, in a literal period of time. And then followed that would be the judgment and then final state. Most of them are literalistic interpreters. They read the symbolic language, and the symbolism must be interpreted as a literal fact. And so you can't say that the symbol is fulfilled unless it's fulfilled in the exact words that are used to describe it. That's the way they approach it. But what encouragement would this attitude toward this writing, this book, what encouragement would that offer the people who lived in the time of John? Something going to happen 2,000 years in the future? Is that going to help the people in John's day? That to know that 2,000 or maybe more years than that in the future, the Lord's going to take care of Satan and this persecuting powers. Doesn't sound too reasonable to me. A second method of interpretation is described as the continuous historical method. And this view presents the book as a forecast in symbols of the history of the church. So it sees in the book the rise of the papacy, the rise of Islam. It sees the Reformation movement, the Restoration movement would be this millennial period, and most of the early brethren in the early 1800s took the post-millennial position, and so this is the background out of which that idea came. Now, again, the same question we can ask that we ask about the futurist position. What goods, what encouragement, what benefit would that provide to the people who lived in the days of John? If you're going to tell them what's going to happen for the next 2,000 years or more, and they're suffering persecution under the powers that be, and what are you going to do to help them to know something happened 2,000 years from now? I think that's a question that we need to ask ourselves. Should we look at it from that point of view? And then there's another idea, is that it really is devoting to a philosophy of history. And this method of interpretation considers the symbols as pointing not necessary to actual events, but to symbolic forces at work. Temporal and spiritual forces in which the spiritual are victorious. And hence Revelation is a book setting forth the principles on the basis of which God deals with men in all ages. Now there's some of that, I think, such validity to that idea in some of it. And then there is what is called the preterist view. And this view maintains the book was written primarily to the people of John's day, fulfilled then, has little or no value for us today. And there are two groups that hold this. The right wing consider Revelation as inspired, and the left wing reject it as uninspired. So if they think it referred to on the days of John, it was just like some other apocalyptic literature, doesn't have any really significance. And then the finalists call the historical background, lack of a better word. And this method of interpretation seeks to find the message that the book had in the days of its origin. What was this message to the people in John's day? And as it is written to the people of John's day, it is fulfilled in the events immediately after that. He says he's going to show you things that must shortly come to pass. And if we take that as true, that it has reference to things that would soon occur after the revelation was first given. And we have to look at the background of that sign. Sometimes people say for the first 2 centuries, but this background is providing the background for the message of this book. So these are the choices you have. Are you going to approach the book as a futurist? Or are you going to approach the book as it gives you a continual history? Are you going to approach it as a philosophy of history or preterist view or the historical background? I think you might have a little things particularly the last one in the philosophy involved, as you see the principles that are set forth applied to the situation in John's day. Now, some rules we might suggest for studying this book. Number one, we must remember that the Revelation was written primarily for the encouragement and edification of the Christians in the writer's own time. That is a fundamental principle that we need to understand. When you approach it, think about what benefit would this be to the people of John's day. Secondly, we need to understand that the book was written largely in symbolic language. So it cannot be taken literally in every case. Now, sometimes the book itself explains the symbols. We'll look at that in the next hour. The seven stars, the seven angels are explained in the last verse of the first chapter. So sometimes you have the explanation in the text itself. And so we need to watch for that as we go along. And so it was written in symbolic language, and we can ill afford to be dogmatic in interpreting these symbols that are not so easily understood. Understanding that it's symbolism. The symbolism comes primarily from the Old Testament. You need to understand some background. Maybe I might suggest another book. Farrell Jenkins wrote his thesis for his master's degree on the book of Revelation in the Old Testament, something of that nature. But anyway, he shows how the book of Revelation uses symbols from the Old Testament scriptures. Now, they take the symbols, he points this out, they don't always take the symbol and just duplicate it in the book of Revelation. But the idea is taken from the symbolism of the Old Testament in those passages. And we can see that as we go along as illustration from time to time. We can't be dogmatic in interpreting symbols. And before I forget it, I might mention this. Sometimes when we study Revelation, we get so busy and so intent on trying to uncover the significance and meaning of every single word that we miss the whole story. We miss the point. So I want to caution you. As you read the book of Revelation, first of all, you try to use your mind's eye. Let John describe what he saw. And try to visualize in your mind as John described it. So that's the first step. We need to try to see what John was seeing. He tells us, he describes this vision. Now it has meaning, and we'll try to talk about those as we go along. But we need to try to see that. Adults have a problem with that. You know, kids, young, little kids, and the first time we did this in Elizabethtown many years ago when Bob was, and Linda were there, somebody came to talk to some of the little classes. We just do it for the whole church. And so the teachers of the little classes were teaching the book of Revelation too. And they said, you know, the kids don't have as much problem with the symbolism as the adults do. Their minds are not cluttered up with all this literalism that we are sensed on today. And they can use their imagination. Now, we've got to free our imaginations to try to see the scenes that John describes. And that's, I think, something that is significant. And we have to remember that this uses the Old Testament terminology, but it uses with a New Testament meaning. John used the terminology of Ezekiel and Daniel, but adapted them to his own purposes. So in understanding of the prophets, their use of symbols would be helpful. There are over 400 allusions to the Old Testament scriptures in Revelation. And we must understand that difficult passages in the light of clear passages. And we need to be sure that we make all of our interpretations consistent with the teaching of the Bible in whole. We just can't take the book of Revelation out by itself and insist that it means something, and that insistence may make it contradict what was taught somewhere else in the Scripture. And then finally, we want to talk about, as I backed it up, What is the purpose? What is the theme? The message, primary message. As we study the book, we'll see that the theme emphasizes that there is a conflict going on between God and Satan, between the church and the Roman force of Roman paganism. That's brought out clearly in chapter 12, 13, and 14. The message that we need to learn is that things are not always as they seem. The beast that come out of the bottomless pit or the abyss seems to be victorious in chapter 17. And the wicked rejoice. The two witnesses are killed. They're dead for 3.5 days, but they're raised again. And depicting there that the believer ultimately triumphs. God's, the cause of the Lord ultimately triumphs, even though it seems at times that there's victory for the forces of evil. Now, sometimes you and I face those problems, don't we? We get discouragement. The devil is after us. He goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Even though Revelation tells us he's been chained with a chain, he's like a dog on a leash. Or I think about a dog, maybe like some put their dog out to outside, they put him on a leash and have a post over here and a post over here and a wire between it. They attach the leash to the wire. He may be a vicious dog, but you stay away from the distance that he can travel from post to post or the length of the leash, and you're safe. But if you get too close, he can get you. The devil can do that if we get too close. And I think that's maybe an apt illustration of the idea we need to learn from that. So the message is that all the wicked things that take place are not the ultimate answer. It's not the ultimate situation. It is the believer, the one who believes and puts his trust and confidence in the Lord and remains faithful in the service of the Lord, is the one who ultimately was on the winning side. You remember Christ defeats the devil. And if you're on the Lord's side, not say that Christ is on my side. If I'm on the Lord's side, I'll be on the winning side. And that's the attitude that we need to take. And so the purpose is to encourage faithfulness in the face of all opposition. It doesn't make any difference how difficult the time gets. We must remain faithful in our affections of the Lord. Think about what Jesus said. He that saves his life shall lose it. He that loses his life for my sake shall save it. You may save your skin by compromising with the devil. You may save your skin to keep from being persecuted, physically assaulted, lose economic advantage or social advantages. But you just remember, if you stay with that materialistic concept of things, you will save your physical life, but you may lose the most important thing that you have. What will a man give in exchange for his soul? In Revelation 2:10, be thou faithful unto death, I will give you a crown of life. Look at the reward that is promised to the faithful. You may die as a martyr, as some did, as we read in Revelation. But the faithful will be given a crown of life. Life itself is the crown. And we are to encourage, and the book encourages us to be faithful in the face of all opposition. The cause of Christ will ultimately be victorious overall. Sometimes it seems that that may not be true, but it is true. I think that's enough for this particular hour. Has anybody got a question that you want to raise in the last 5 minutes? Brother Wilson.
Are there things in Revelation that apply directly to us? I look at the last chapter.
Well, all the principles that say Christ is victorious over the Satan and his allies is a lesson that we need to learn. And we're going to face the lesson that comes in the last chapters is that we're going to face the Lord in judgment. He's the one who's going to judge us, and he's going to judge us according to what is recorded in the books, and he's going to be determined whether our name is in the book of life, the Lamb's book of life, or whether we've got the mark of the beast on us. The devil's people marked his people. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be a literal mark, like a Hindu having a red dot on his face, something like that. But it means that a person is identified as allied with the devil. We need to have Christ's approval of us, brother.
It's almost a challenge. The numerical symbology that you're using, how would you respond to that? Where does the information you get come from?
Well, I think the information comes from how symbolism of numbers were used in the centuries immediately before and after the Apostolic Age. So that's the foundation of the numbers that I suggested. And the biblical encyclopedias give you some discussion about the symbolism there. And I think that would be helpful if you want to look up some more. And you look up the numbers. And if you read a good commentary, most of them will tell you what this symbol, this number meant and how this number was used.
It's widely accepted. It's just that some of the literalists don't accept it.
Yeah. Well, they accept it, but they won't accept it in literally in the sense of a seven. It was seven literal churches. There might have been more churches, but since seven is a full number, other churches could be included. And you read those seven letters of the seven churches, and every one of them closes with the statement, "He that has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Every church was supposed to hear not just what was addressed to that particular congregation, but to what the Spirit had revealed to all the churches. And could have had, in other words, when you spread the message beyond Asia, it has the same message to all those folks, and it still has the basic message, the principles involved apply even today. There are a lot of principles in the book of Revelation that are applicable to us. Well, I think the fundamental would say historical. From the starting off with the history of John's day, what message, what application did it have to the people living when John was alive? And then you go from there, and how do the principles apply to us? And so we may say there's a philosophy of history to some extent from that point of view. It gives us an illustration of it, but it's not specifically designed to any particular period beyond that particular period of time. That's my vision. Go ahead.
But the, like Brother Steve was saying, that the second coming, none of that has been...
Well, no. I don't think the second coming is taking place. I'm going to be pointing out that sometimes when you read, you get down to a certain point, and you got... many years ago, when I first started trying to study, the only thing we had was Hendrickson's book, More Than Conquerors. It was being taught by Brother Haley down at Florida College when he first started teaching down there. And so Hendrickson pointed out, and I think helpfully so, that the book has about seven periods, seven divisions in the book. And in the handout that I had this folded, you have a Brother Jenkins chart showing an overall view of the different sides prior to the 12th chapter, which gets behind the scenes. The first chapter talks about what's going on earth, what's happening in the lives of the people. And then the last chapter shows what's going on behind that, the conflict between Christ and the woman and her seed. And so this, I think, would be helpful. So hopefully everybody can be able to be with us and catch up on the details as we go along.